couple of weeks ago, I went and gave a speech to the St. Louis Skeptical Society, a group of several dozen people who get together on a monthly basis for an event called Skeptics in the Pub. And one of the things that I talked about that night was people who believe that vaccines cause autism, anti-vaxxers, as they're called, who have unfortunately poisoned the well of healthy children, not just in the United States, but also in the world. What it came from was a horrible piece of science done by a guy named Andrew Wakefield, who published a piece in The Lancet, the British medical journal, several years ago, in which he made the link between vaccines and autism, a link that was bogus. The Lancet has since retracted that article. Wakefield still stands by what he said. But unfortunately, he gained followers around the world, including many in this country, the most famous of whom would be the actress and former Playboy playmate Jenny McCarthy. She got access to great media attention by going on The Oprah Show and talking extensively about her child who had autism and had gotten it through vaccines and made all sorts of claims and scared a lot of people. The problem with doing that is that there's a concept in science called herd immunity, which is the more people who you get who you can vaccinate who don't have the disease, the lesser chance there is of the rest of the people in the herd, if you will, ever getting that disease. This is how we defeated smallpox. It's how we've defeated many diseases and have gotten quite a few things like whooping cough, pertussis, on the run. Unfortunately, because of anti-vaxxers, we now are losing some of that herd immunity in places, so that in California, pertussis, whooping cough, has made such a return that the Department of Health there has labeled it an epidemic. They are having similar problems in Australia, where unfortunately the anti-vaccination movement is even bigger than it is here in the United States. All of this based on bogus claims from an English scientist. So I talked about this a couple of weeks ago at the Skeptics in the Pub speech that I gave, and afterwards Dr. Christina Stevens came up to me and thanked me for being there and also said, I know a little bit about autism, and she filled me in on some things that I did not know. And I was fascinated by what she had to say, and so I said, you know what, I'm going to be doing the McGraw Show in a couple of weeks on KTRS. Why don't you join me, and we'll talk about it. So she's joining me here in the studio. Christina, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. First of all, the first thing you told me which shocked me is it turns out Jenny McCarthy's kid doesn't have autism.
Well, basically what happened with Jenny McCarthy is that when her child started developing symptoms, it was after he started having lots of different seizures. And after that, his symptoms slowly progressed, and then after that, they subsided. Now, Jenny McCarthy thinks that all of the alternative therapies that she gave her son, Evan, is what caused his symptoms to subside, and now she thinks that he no longer has autism at all. Well, there's a lot of contention that maybe he never had autism in the first place. So there's a disorder called Landau-Kleffner syndrome, and what that syndrome is it's a language disorder that starts with seizures. So a child has a bunch of seizures. He has seizure disorder. It causes neurological issues in the brain, and then it causes a language disorder, which can resolve. Sometimes the children end up with long-lasting symptoms, and sometimes their symptoms completely resolve, especially with different types of therapies.
Mm-hmm. So we run a second risk here of Jenny McCarthy now telling people that her child was autistic and she's cured him.
Right, exactly.
Is there really any cure for autism?
There's really not a cure for autism. So I've been working with kids who have autism for about 6 years. I've been doing it since before I had a doctoral degree.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens is that parents are willing to do anything at all to cure their child of autism. They have this kid who doesn't look them in the eye, who doesn't hug them, who has no language or limited language, and they're willing to do absolutely anything to cure their child. And the best scientific evidence shows that there is no cure for autism, but that the symptoms of autism slowly subside over time as children grow and develop, and different therapies like behavioral therapies and speech therapies can help mitigate some of those symptoms.
Mm-hmm. So while you can't get rid of autism, you can lessen its effects.
Right, exactly.
Okay. Does this mean that we also have quite a few kids who are diagnosed with autism who actually are not autistic?
Right. I think that that definitely is the case. Studies, there's lots of different studies that show that the autism rates are on the rise. And one of the things you have to ask yourself is why autism is on the rise. So it could be an environmental factor. So, for example, it could be vaccines. That's an interesting theory, and it's a theory that was investigated and proven to not have any link. But what's interesting is that you look at autism diagnosis, and you also look at corresponding diagnosis of things like multiple or things like mental retardation or PPD, which is pervasive developmental disorder, or language disorders. And you notice that as the autism rates have risen, the corresponding rates of PPD and MR have gone down.
Mm-hmm.
So what's happening is that kids in the past who would have been diagnosed as MR or PPD or having language disorder are now getting diagnosed as having autism.
Mm-hmm. Is that because perhaps we were putting kids in a broad umbrella of mental retardation, not understanding quite what it was, and now we can be more specific about it? Or is autism now becoming the catch-all?
It's that autism is becoming the catch-all. So in the 1990s, they actually broadened the autism diagnosis to include a whole spectrum of disorders. So autism used to be one diagnosis, your kid has autism.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's a huge spectrum where your kid has mild autism all the way to your kid has severe autism, and even including a syndrome called Asperger's disorder, which is an even milder form of autism that's not quite classifiable as autism.
Okay, let's go back to the vaccines for a second, because I want to reiterate the fact that there is no causal link. There is no evidence proving that vaccines cause autism, correct?
There's absolutely no link.
Okay. It's important for us to restate that, because I don't want anybody to go away from this discussion saying, I heard Paul and Dr. Stevens talking about this, and now I'm not going to get my kid vaccinated against all the things that children need to be vaccinated against. And the fact that we still have people out there in this movement who are repeating this lie, which is what it is, as I said, it's scientifically harmful. But talk to me about the effect it has on the autistic community. When you're talking about kids with autism, and particularly parents who have children with autism, how does this lie being spread affect them?
Well, for one, parents then blame themselves because they're the ones who took their kids to the doctor to get the vaccine. And for two, people are so afraid of vaccines that they're not vaccinating their children. And I can totally understand, because vaccines are kind of a scary thing. You know, you take your kid into there, they get jabbed with a needle and they cry, and it's traumatizing for parents. It's traumatizing for the kids. So if you think of that traumatizing event and then you put this link with vaccines and autism, you think, oh my gosh, this, I'm going to take my kid, he's going to get poked with this needle, he's going to cry, and then he might get autism.
Yeah.
That's a scary thing. So it makes parents afraid of vaccines.
Tell me about the kind of work that you do with autistic kids.
So before I became a doctor, before I got a degree in occupational therapy, I worked as a behavioral therapist for kids with autism. So I worked in a grade school. I did behavioral therapy for kids. It's a lot of behaviorism, so looking at the motivations for why kids are behaving in the way that they are and teaching kids more appropriate ways of getting what they want, so teaching them to communicate better. For example, if a kid wants a certain toy that's on top of a shelf and he can't get to it, if he has autism, he might cry and scream and roll around on the floor because he wants that toy. Well, we do things like teach him more appropriate ways of getting the toy that he wants. So we'll teach him to ask for the toy, which in typical kids, in neurotypical kids, it's really easy to teach a kid that. But in a kid with autism, it's really hard for a kid with autism to understand that. So you have to repeat that over and over and over again until the kid understands that, oh, I can get this toy by saying, I want toy.
Mm-hmm. How do you measure success in helping out autistic children? Is just getting him to ask for that a major thing?
It is a major thing for some kids with autism. It really depends. Like I said, since autism is such a huge spectrum, now it really depends. So you might have some kids that need therapy where you teach them social stories. So, for example, you might teach them how to interact socially through stories and through books, and they learn better through those books, and then they can apply that social skill outside of the therapy.
Mm-hmm. We always hear about high-functioning children with autism. Everybody knows the movie Rain Man, and they associate that, oh, I want my kid to be able to do math. If only he was autistic so he could do math,
right.
so that he could count toothpicks when they fall on the floor, you know, that sort of thing. People see that skill and don't understand what the connection is there. there must be parents who come to you who have a child who has problems. Perhaps they are problems that fall under that mental retardation umbrella that you were talking about. Perhaps they fall under the autistic umbrella. When you have to do work with those children and try to teach them not just behavioral things, but real academic things, what are the big challenges for anybody who's involved in that sort of therapy?
To be honest, with children, the big problem with teaching them academic things is motivating them to do academic things. Sometimes they're not interested in doing math or learning reading, and sometimes math and reading are really difficult for them, and so it's especially difficult to get them to be motivated to do academic schoolwork if it's really hard for them.
Mm-hmm. It's mostly the motivation?
I would say so, yeah. It really depends on the kid. Like I said, since it's a huge spectrum, behavioral therapy for autism is very individualized, mm-hmm. So it really depends on the child.
And for those kids who are high-functioning autistics, who can have more of a life can they have a life that is more independent, or do they also need the constant care that somebody who is not a high-functioning autistic child would need?
Once again, it depends on the kid. It's really difficult just to say whether or not, you know, a kid can live a normal life. A lot of kids can live a normal life. They can get jobs. I know, you know, kids with autism who grow up. I actually have a friend who has autism who is, she's a few years younger than I, so she's probably like 25, and she's been married, and, you know, she lived a pretty good life. She mm-hmm. actually still is, it's kind of a long story, she still lives with her family, but she lives pretty independently.
All right, I'm going to take a break here, and then we'll open up our Verizon Wireless listener lines, because autism, the question of whether it's on the rise in reality, there certainly is the perception that it's on the rise, and I know a lot of people who've encountered this and probably have questions about it. So Dr. Christina Stevens is my guest here on The McGraw Show. The phone number is 314-969-KTRS, toll-free 1-888-550-KTRS, and on your cell phone, *KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, back in a moment on the Big 550 KTRS.
McGraw in the Morning continues on the Big 550 KTRS.
With Paul Harris sitting here with Dr. Christina Stevens, who's, what's your official title now?
Well, I'm an academic researcher at Washington University, and I'm also a clinician. Mm-hmm. So my doctor is that I'm a doctor of occupational therapy.
Yeah, works with autistic children, and we've been talking about this after I met Christina a couple of weeks ago at a Skeptics in the Pub meeting from the St. Louis Skeptical Society. And we got discussing the bogus work of Dr. Andrew Wakefield. We were, in fact, talking about him during the commercials here. He's the guy who used a study that he published in The Lancet, a British medical journal, which found a causal link between vaccines and autism. Completely false. And Christina just told me that the reason behind it was a lawsuit that somebody had filed making that link and wanted to sue the vaccine company. Was that it?
Right, exactly. So he was working for some lawyers and some kids who had autism, and he was trying to find a link between autism and MMR.
Well, he wasn't trying to find the link. He was going to make the claim that there was a link. That was his conclusion, and then he did the research.
Yes, exactly, which is not how you do science, ever.
No. Conclusion last, not first.
Right, exactly.
Thesis first, conclusion last.
Right, exactly. And so he's had his license revoked, and The Lancet has retracted that paper.
Right. How early can you diagnose autism in a child?
Well, autism is a symptom-based diagnosis. So you diagnose children based on the symptoms that they present. So typically that diagnosis, in the earliest, is maybe like 18 months. So you start to see a lot of diagnoses around 24 months. So mm-hmm. 18 to 36. But it can even be a diagnosed in adulthood. That's kind of what's happening a lot of the time now, is that kids who were previously diagnosed as having MR, which is mental retardation, as adults are now saying, you know what, maybe you've got autism, actually, now that I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the interesting thing is that research has shown that there are brain abnormalities in unborn fetuses of kids who have autism, which is leading researchers to believe that you have autism from birth and that the symptoms later develop, so that later you get a diagnosis when the symptoms are more obvious.
So that first you actually have it, and then the symptoms develop later on.
Right,
exactly. Or perhaps you have symptoms younger that we don't notice yet.
Right, exactly. When you have an infant, it's kind of hard to tell. I mean, what do infants do? They eat and they sleep and they poop, basically.
Right.
So it's a little hard to pick up on some little minor details, minor things that you might not notice. And parents don't know all the symptoms of autism. They've got this beautiful baby. It's really awesome. They might not notice maybe that it's not making so much eye contact.
Mm-hmm. So did you say that we could find this in fetuses?
Yeah, there are brain abnormalities in children with autism in utero.
Interesting. All right, let me take a couple of phone calls here. 314-969-KTRS, toll-free, 1-888-550-KTRS. Cell phones, *KTRS. Those are our Verizon Wireless listener lines. Peter, good morning. You're on the Big 550.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I'd like to make a suggestion. I'm a PhD psychologist as well as a healthcare executive. It seems to me that as the autism lobbyists across the country have done an incredible job of having states mandate services for autistic children, the prevalence of autism has gone up simply because the funding for autism has gone up. So if you follow the Woodward and Bernstein follow the money theory, it makes sense that kids which were previously being serviced by state agencies or educational agencies, now that third-party payers are mandated to pay for services, it makes sense that those cases might now be considered autistic simply because the money's there to service these kids.
Christina, do you think that there's a link in the increase in autism diagnoses because of the insurance?
I absolutely think that there is an increase, yes. There's increased surveillance, for one, so we're trying to pick up on those kids that might have been missed out on before, so especially with the milder cases. And there is definitely a lot more services available for kids who have autism. So what I think is happening now, and what research has shown, is that parents are now seeking an autism diagnosis, whereas before they might have not sought an autism diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And that's especially true in the 1950s when an autism diagnosis was seriously stigmatized.
But there are two different things here, and Peter, maybe you want to jump in on this as well. There's the question of, are we having kids who are diagnosed as autism because the money is there, or because the money is there, are we now actually discovering more children who had autism, but we didn't know it before?
I think it's both. What do you think?
I would agree that it's both, but my suspicion is again, as a clinician who sees parents come into my office, you really try to do your best to link services for them in any way you can. And it makes sense to me that if I'm going to help these people, particularly if I have some financial advantage by doing so, I'm going to lean one way versus the other. I don't think it's simply that the diagnostics has gotten better. I do believe that the finances have shaded it more to one side than the other.
Right, and I completely agree. I think you're absolutely right.
Peter, thanks for calling. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
314-969-KTRS, toll-free, 1-888-550-KTRS, cell phone *KTRS. Bill, you're on the Big 550. Hello.
Thank you, Paul, for taking my call. Doctor, you've already alluded to this. We have a 28-year-old autistic son. We have it's been a challenge for our family. We've actually moved from the school district here in St. Louis to Wisconsin for a period of time to get him educated. There was a wide difference in the philosophies on how to handle disabled children. We have since moved back since he's reached the end of his school career. I was traveling with some medical doctors, just happened to travel with them in the West Coast, and they were doctors that were at in school, and they felt that autism is really going to make advances through the use of computer technology. Computer technology as far as isolating the differences of the brain, then breaking down as far as how to attack those differences for autistic children. Can you elaborate in the last 5 years what they have discovered in, quote, an autistic child versus a, quote, a normal person, and the difference in the brain and how that might lead us to some therapies and help to advance younger children and all older children in the traumatic life of being an autistic person? Thank you.
So you're asking, are
I'm
you still
asking,
there?
Doctor, what has been discovered through the use of computer technology?
As far as the differences in the brain of a child with autism?
Yes.
Well, as far as technology goes, they're discovering that there are a lot of differences in the brain of children with autism. So, for example, their brains are a little bit larger, and they have a different size frontal lobe than neurotypical kids.
And that being said, what type of, is there been any advances in therapy regarding children with differences of brain as far as helping them in early years to become more, and what I would say, normal in their later years?
Let me ask it this way. Can you work with autistic children in any new developing ways now compared to when Bill's child was 2-3 years old and may have first been diagnosed? I mean, if you catch the autism diagnosis early enough now, how much different is it going to be raising a child with autism than it was for Bill and his kid?
Well, the difference would be is that there's a whole lot more social support. There's a whole lot more financial support for kids who have autism. So there's state mandated, you know, if you take your kid to a public school, then there's state mandated education that's specifically meant to fit for that child.
Mm-hmm.
So there's an IEP, it's an individualized education plan, where that child will have its own set of goals and that child will have his or her own set of ways of working towards those goals. So what we're finding is that the earlier we can catch autism, if you will, the better it is for that child, because some of the earlier behavioral services are really helpful for them, for sort of jump starting their ability to understand the world around them.
Okay, so it's really a matter of getting the services together to help a family with a child, discovering it as early as possible, and then working on it as early as possible. That's going to make everybody's life a little bit easier.
Right.
Not to say that being the parent of an autistic child will ever really be easy.
No.
But certainly to make it easier. Bill, I'm glad you called. We've got to take a break. We'll come back with Dr. Christina Stevens here on the McGraw Show with Paul Harris in a moment. 314-969-KTRS, toll free 1-888-550-KTRS, and on your cell phone, *KTRS. 940, it's Paul Harris filling in for McGraw today and tomorrow. Thanks for listening. Sitting here with Dr. Christina Stevens, an occupational therapist from Washington University, who does quite a bit of work with autistic children. And we've been talking about kids and autism and how you help them out, what kind of therapies you can do for them, but also how there are so many more kids being diagnosed with autism now. And you mentioned to me during the break something about the social diagnosis of autism. What is that?
Well, there's a social component to the diagnosis of autism. So to give you an example, in the 1950s and the 1960s, if your child was diagnosed with autism, the prevailing theory was that it was because you were a refrigerator mother.
Refrigerator mother.
Right. So what a refrigerator mother is, and I say that with big air quotes,
mm-hmm.
is that you did not form a proper connection with your son or daughter, and you were cold to your son or daughter. That's where the refrigerator part comes from, that you were cold and uncaring.
Oh, it was your fault as a mom.
It was your fault as a mom. That's
what
they thought.
You made your child autistic because you didn't hug him enough.
Exactly, exactly. And so an autism diagnosis was seriously stigmatized, and for good reason, because there's no causal link between the way a mother treats a child and autism.
Mm-hmm.
But
you can't cause autism by not hugging your child.
Exactly. You cannot cause autism. Please go out and hug your kid, but know if you don't, you're not going to cause your kid to have autism.
Okay.
So physicians did not want to diagnose autism because they would say, look at this really nice, caring, warm mother. Her kid can't have autism because she's obviously not a refrigerator mother. She obviously loves and cares for her child. So it must be something else, like maybe MR or PPD.
Mm-hmm.
So there were not very many autism diagnoses. And there were also not very many autism diagnoses because it wasn't yet then a spectrum. But in the 1950s and 1960s, the mother was blamed for her child having autism. And so as a result, people didn't want an autism diagnosis because they thought that they were to blame for an autism diagnosis.
Right.
And people did not want to diagnose autism for mm-hmm. the same reason.
Right. When did we see that start changing?
Well, about in the 1970s when the refrigerator mother's hypothesis, if you will, started losing favor with the community, which it should have because
mm-hmm.
it's
bogus.
It's bogus.
Yeah.
And then in the 1990s, when the autism diagnosis was brought into a spectrum, then you started seeing the rise of autism diagnosis. So clearly, you're casting a wider net. You're going to get more autism.
Mm-hmm.
And so what's really interesting is that in the 1950s and 1960s, there were a lot more kids who were diagnosed with speech disorder or PPD, which is pervasive developmental disorders, not specified, or MR, which is mental retardation.
Mm-hmm.
So those were really high and autism was really low. And now it's completely the opposite. Now, autism has been destigmatized somewhat as a diagnosis, and MR has been restigmatized as a diagnosis. So people are seeking out, they're mobilizing their efforts to get an autism diagnosis rather than to get an MR diagnosis.
For some of the reasons that we mentioned earlier. All right, thanks for the explanation of refrigerator mothers, which I'd never heard before. Refrigerator magnets, pretty familiar with. Mothers, no. To the phones. Mary, you're on the Big 550 KTRS. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
We have a daughter we adopted internationally, and we knew at the beginning that she was delayed. She wasn't walking and had no words in her, language of her country at age 18 months. So as soon as we came back home, we started getting, therapy for her. We've been to neurologist or pediatrician, everybody, and she has had over the years, it's been 6 years now, she has had every diagnosis you can imagine. And in the course of 12 months, we were at four different doctors, all in different areas, and none of them talked to each other, which is frustrating to us. But she's had everything from, ADHD, possibly affected by alcohol, although she doesn't have the physical characteristics of that. She's had, she does have speech and language problems. And she finally had a diagnosis of, we went to a doctor, reactive attachment disorder was another one. And then finally, at a doctor, and we weren't seeking out different doctors or different diagnoses. We just, through just the doctors we saw, and as I said, some of them were in different specialties, they each gave us a completely different diagnosis and wouldn't even talk about what the other folks had diagnosed. So after 12 months, we had four completely different diagnoses, the last being autism. And that was at age 7. And, from the time she was 18 months old on, I would ask doctors, do you think she's autistic? Because she had some of the symptoms, as you were mentioning. And, we're just completely puzzled. I mean, we don't know, does it matter what her diagnosis is as long as she's getting all the therapies? If we got a diagnosis of autism at age 7, are we late in the game to get, ABA therapy? How do you really, first of all, which doctor, because a neurologist from the get-go, never said that she was autistic, and then finally said at like age 6, well, she may be somewhere on the spectrum.
Can you, let me interrupt for a second, Mary, to ask Christina, can you ever be sure that the child is autistic and not suffering from one of the other things her child was diagnosed with?
Well, since autism is a symptom-based diagnosis, there are other disorders that are very similar to autism. So in a way, you can almost say that you can't always be sure, but it really kind of depends. I mean, since it's a symptom-based diagnosis, it's always kind of a judgment call.
Mm-hmm.
Who typically makes that call? Is it a psychiatrist, a psychologist, a neurologist? We've been to everybody.
Typically, it would be a neurologist. So me, even though I have a doctor in occupational therapy, I cannot make that diagnosis.
Well, what puzzles us is, that it, finally after, years, a doctor saying, well, she might be somewhere on the spectrum of autism. And then, another doctor saying, oh, I have without a doubt, his specialty happens to be adopted children who have been exposed to alcohol in utero. And he's like, without a doubt, some of her delays are due to that. And then another doctor says, oh, no. It doesn't matter whether we know that or not. We wouldn't treat her any differently. I think she's autistic. Another doctor says, a psychiatrist, without a doubt, she has reactive attachment disorder. And then a different doctor, the same group we're going to, is they all have their own specialties. They don't agree with each other, and they don't talk to each other.
All right. So let me ask Christina a question here based on a lot of the things that you've mentioned here. And one of the questions that you actually asked earlier, which is, does it matter at this point what the diagnosis is in the therapies that you're going to use for a child who's now 7 years old, who obviously is suffering from symptoms that may be autism or maybe something like autism or maybe something that's not autism at all? Can you still have similar therapies for a child in these circumstances?
Yes, you can have similar therapies. So, for example, as far as behavioral therapy goes, whether it's autism or reactive attachment disorder, they're going to base the therapies on your child's behavior. So the actual diagnosis really is not going to change the behavioral therapy to any extent that's going to really matter.
But does ABA, you know, I've heard of some of my friends that have autistic kids and they start that so young. If you try and bring that into the picture in the home at age 7 or 8, is that going to have any impact on her?
Yes, it will absolutely have an impact, even if it started just a little bit late. That's okay. It's behavioral therapy. So your child's behavior is going to be changed whether they're 7 or 13 months or...
But to me, behavior therapy is completely different just based on what I know about reactive attachment disorder. The approach used is pretty different in an autistic child versus reactive attachment disorder because you're dealing with so much with reactive attachment disorder, you know, where very structured methods used in ABA to me seem like they would almost, and based on what our psychologist says, that could be very, you know, different depending on what your diagnosis is. And that a psychologist's approach is different based on what the diagnosis is. And that's why, and we can't get these people to agree.
Yeah.
Right, yeah, that definitely sounds really frustrating for you. I can completely understand your frustration and your want to make your child better.
I hope you find something that works for your kid, Mary. I'm glad you called. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're all out of time. Dr. Christina Stevens from Washington University, thank you so much for your time today. It's been a pleasure having you in here and filling me in on a lot of this field where, as I mentioned earlier, for most people, autism, that's the Rain Man thing, isn't it? And that's all we know about it.
Right, yeah.
But there are more and more kids who are being diagnosed with this, and it's important to at least get them the help. And that's what the bottom line is, and that's what you're doing on a regular basis. So hats off to you for that.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me on.
Dr. Christina Stevens here with Paul Harris on the McGraw Show on the Big 550 KTRS.